You guys all here for a kaiju panel? You need to brush up on your kaiju because there's some Godzilla cookie pops and buttons that you can win.
It is, however, all defended by the Mazer cannon. So be careful.
I'm trying to steal one.
That is bravo. Do we need another chair?
He's going to stand up eventually.
Okay.
Because he's going to draw.
Okay.
Yes.
Where do you want to be?
Where am I going to sit my bottom down?
We will eventually have this chair open. But here, you sit here. Okay. I'm going to moderate, so I can stand.
Okay. Us in our silly modern day accoutrement.
Fangled inventions.
Are you gonna wear that hat?
Not yet.
All right.
Lovely, thank you.
I'm going to do a quick test, make sure all this is
all right.
There you are.
All right, anybody who's out there on social media, go ahead and share that the kaiju panel is going to start and you can get cookies.
Not any cookies.
What?
Can you all hear the Bob Crew generation?
Okay.
All right, excellent.
Groovy.
I'm going to say goodbye to Bob Crew for a second and get our... and try to sit my posterior.
You could stand.
I could stand.
All right, we're ready to go?
Boy,
all right. Welcome, everyone, to San Diego Comic Fest and to our kaiju panel. I am Beth Accomando from KPBS, but for today, I'm going to wear my kaiju hat. So that I can moderate this panel. Yes. All right. Because now I get to write this off as a business expense. I got it. So, we have a panel today on kaiju, and we're going to talk to a few people. We had a few changes in our lineup here. So, some of the names are not all correct. This is not Beth Accomando. This is Miguel Rodriguez of Horrible Imaginings Film Festival.
Hello.
This is Josh Gilliland, who got recruited at the last minute. He's from Legal Geeks. And then we have Hiroshi Katatani, who is an artist who is launching his own, his own kaiju comic book. And what we're going to be doing to start this off, and this is Edward, who is going to help us translate for him. He's helping. But what we want to do, Hiroshi doesn't want to speak too much English, but he is brilliant with a pen. So what we're going to have him do is during the whole panel, he is going to be drawing something up here, his own character. And before he starts, I wanted to have him talk a little bit about the character that he is creating for his comic.
Hello, everybody. I'm Hiroshi Kanatani, a Japanese cartoonist, manga artist. And this is... let me introduce my manga, new manga. This is... my new manga, Shachi Ho Kong. It is a Gotochi Kaiju project. Gotochi Kaiju, Gotochi means local. It's a local kaiju. One prefecture has one kaiju. So, Gotochi Kaiju project invited me to draw the manga.
Just a little bit about Gotochi Kaiju project. It's a project that's designed by Hiroshi Sagai, who works on Ultraman and Godzilla. He's also a hobby Japan model builder, designer, diorama builder, and Sojiro Uchino, who was in Ultra Q and Gamera. So they already had a project existing, and then they came to Kanatani-san, who is in Shikoku, in Hiroshima, and ask him, we have this character from Aichi Prefecture, which is near Gifu, and we want to do something with it. So he's the first Japanese manga artist in Japan that's actually created a comic on all these prefectural kaiju. We have these available at the table. This is the English version. So there's an English version, there's a Japanese version, there's also a Taiwanese version. So Kanatani-san's comics have been in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan, and now America here.
And he's got a booth which is downstairs next to where you pick up badges and stuff. I don't know if it has a number.
It's like Eaton Room right next to registration.
So, whenever he wants to start, he can start. Would you like to?
Would you like to say something about
idols?
I was going to say a little bit about idols.
Sure.
Idols.
Let's
go. All right. You can start.
Okay. I designed one kaiju, Iros. The name is Iros. Iros' name is, my name is Hiroshi. Hiroshi, the middle is Iros. So.
So his character is a combination of all the things he's been doing for years. He started long ago working with a person named Kenichi Murayda. Kenichi Murayda has his own production company in Tokyo, but he lives in Kyushu. Kenichi Murayda, has anybody seen the Kamen Rider Spirits comic books? Anybody know the Kamen Rider character? So Kamen Rider Spirits is Kenichi Murayda's project. So years ago, Shotaro Ishinomori, one of the biggest names of manga around the world, created Kamen Rider with Toru Hirayama. Shotaro Ishinomori, of course, has passed away. Kenichi Murayda is the second wave of Kamen Rider comic books. He does many things. So Hiroshi got his start working with Kenichi Murayda for 7 years in Tokyo. And at that point, Kenichi Murayda spoke with Hiroshi and said, Hiroshi asked, so would you like me to work with your company to continue? He goes, no, you have graduated from me. You are now a manga artist. So he's now doing it on his own. So he got the blessing from somebody who learned of it, Shotaro Ishinomori.
All right. So to give a sense of what you're going to have to do to win these cookies, and there's going to be a bigger prize at the end, but Miguel, do you want to start with the first trivia?
Well, since nobody raised their hand when asked about Kamen Rider, I have to say something. You guys, you have not seen Kamen Rider. You need to see it. How many of you have seen Ultraman? Okay, see, that's what I would expect. Okay, so take Ultraman and put him on a motorcycle. It's incredible. But the first season, going back to 1967... 71. A couple of years later. Ultraman was 66. And then, yeah, it's... The martial arts in that first season are incredible, and the stunts are just insane for being a TV show.
Is that the Kamen Rider with the sweet ascot?
Yes. Awesome. This is indeed one and the same. Yeah, great fashion sense, great costume, great motorcycle. As long as we're on the very brief subject of tokusatsu superhero shows, it's one of my favorites. We're going ahead with this.
We've got a little trivia game.
We do. We have a game to win.
It all has to do with audio.
We'll start off
easy. Raise your hand if you know the answer.
Yeah, I'm going to be looking. Someone else might have to look for me, too.
Play.
Yeah, I'll play. Name that kaiju. Oh.
Hang it up.
Gojira. Very good.
We're starting easy.
That is starting easy. Whoa, there we go.
While we're doing the contest and stuff, I think
extra points if you can name which year.
Oh, 54.
Very good. Yes, that is the original. I think that would be not fair.
You should get a cookie with that shirt. Look at that.
I know. That is glorious. Woo!
All right.
Okay. So Miguel runs Horrible Imaginings Film Festival.
I do.
And one of the early years he had, he ran the original Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
So Talk a little bit about the original Godzilla and why you felt it was important to bring that film back and kind of introduce it to an audience where not everyone might have known what it was.
I think almost everybody in that audience we showed it to, that was 2011, showed it to that year, had never seen the original 1954 Gojira. A lot had seen the 1955 Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is what I think probably all, if not most of us here, grew up with. Speaking of which, I think I do have some postcards up there. I was asked to write an essay for a collection of essays called My Favorite Horror Movie. And you know, people, I think like some of the creators of movies like Saw and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like there's a lot of really awesome names who've contributed to this. So first of all, I was really kind of giddy to be asked to write an essay. And you know, we were asked to write about our favorite horror movie and what it meant to us and why. And I chose 1954 Gojira. And the editor, I've always had people ask if I thought that was necessarily a horror film. And it absolutely is, particularly the original version. I mean, it's an expression of post-traumatic stress disorder. Through the filter of fantasy, and it does so in such a potent way, and that's what I wanted to share with people. A lot of people know Godzilla as I don't know if you remember the flying drop kick from Godzilla versus Megalon. that is, and I do not want to disparage that either. I am a big fan of those films. I grew up with those films. But I did want to point out that the original Japanese film by Hondo Ishiro is very, very different. And I open my essay with a quote, well, actually with one quote from one of the greatest films called Hiroshima Mon Amour. But another quote by Tomoyoshi Tanaka himself. He was the producer of basically the entire Showa era of Godzilla films and other fantasy films at Toho. And the quote is, from the start, Godzilla was about the terror of the bomb. And I don't think that you can get more terrifying than that, particularly from an artist who had friends and family and colleagues who all experienced those bombs firsthand. And that really is what this film's about. And I wanted our audience to understand that Godzilla was more than this is actually 54 here. I've got 64 over there with facing off against his antagonist at the time, the lovely Mothra. Mm-hmm. It eventually did progress into a large series of films that was aimed at children, because those children were who were going to the theater at the time still.
And buying toys.
But the very first film was definitely not necessarily for kids. But I still recommend showing it and discussing it, because it's an interesting film when put in a historical context. It's somber. It's a lot darker. And it's actually quite beautiful at times too. I mean that last Ifukube score, particularly that last, it's his masterpiece, the chorus near the end, that is just paying homage to the destruction that's gone. It's still, I mean, I'm almost tearing up just talking about it. It's such a powerful score. And by the way, speaking of the roar, it is Ifukube, the composer of the music, who created the voices for a lot of these kaiju, these monsters. This is what sets them apart. You know, in American monster films, a lot of times they would take lions and bears and tigers and kind of scramble them up and make these loud, larger-than-life monster noises. But Ifukube would use musical instruments. And what it did is it gives them a unique voice that is both kind of natural and unnatural at the same time, and musical. So you hear that Godzilla roar, and you know it's immediately recognizable, and you cannot recreate it any other way. And so, in case you don't know, there's a stringed instrument called a contrabass, and Ifukube had a leather glove covered in resin and scraped his hand along the strings, and then took that sound and played with that in the sound mixer, and
created that sound that no human can reproduce, mm-hmm. and it's fantastic. So obviously, why would I show that? I'm in love with that film. It's everything to me. So that's the real reason. I just wanted to see it myself. And on that note, one point of pride for me too. Rialto had just restored the film. It is now out on Criterion. If you have not gotten that Blu-ray, it's a masterpiece. But ours was the first theatrical presentation of the restoration.
And then we don't want to score the film because what you're saying is it's very hard even today. Mm-hmm. The director himself fought in the Japanese army, mm-hmm. and worked until the end. The composer worked until mm-hmm. the end. And Ishiro Honda went on to work with Akira Kurosawa many times, up until the end of his life.
I've been reading a wonderful biography on Honda that covers his war experience. And
excellent.
The poor guy was drafted back into service, I think, 5 times. And talking about what he went through, because he avoided getting into fighting the U.S. Mm-hmm. So he was at a comfort station in China, and where he developed very strong feminist views because of what those women were going through, that's later depicted in his early films, mm-hmm. with being a very feminist icon for Japanese films, which is... wasn't expected. So there's all these wonderful contradictions between traditionalism and looking forward.
And all female roles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. just wonderful human being.
Well, I mean, and on that point, like one of his earliest series is a series of documentaries on pearl divers, mm-hmm. and he used a lot of the techniques in making his fantasy films. When you watch the fantasy films of Honda, they are filmed almost in a documentarian style, where you are presented with these goings on that are happening. It's far more like you're there, like you're watching something that's happening. That's why it kind of works when the American version happens and they stick, you know, Steve Martin into that role as a reporter, and he's just watching it happen and reporting it with a microphone. It feels like you're watching a newscast in that first one.
Amazingly so, they did all that footage about 2.5 days,
mm-hmm.
with Raymond Burr.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't look like 2.5 days at work. It looks like it took a lot of time doing it.
Covered in sweat.
Yeah. All right, why don't we do another round? And we're going to get a little harder.
A little harder, though.
It's little baby steps. Little Godzilla baby steps.
Okay.
Minya
steps.
Oh, no. Well, let's see if you know this one. Ooh.
Yes.
In Gears?
That is correct.
Very good, sir.
The D-List Monster, which is actually pretty popular in America.
Yeah.
Although, on the American dub version of Godzilla Race Again,
yeah.
reversed.
They did. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Ah.
It, the voices were reversed.
But George Takei was one of them.
All right, why don't you play one more?
That was a good one. That was a good bit of trivia,
and
by the way.
He was quick there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, moving it up. Oh,
the phone volume down a little.
Turn your phone.
Sure.
They're kaiju. They're pretty loud.
They are. They are.
They're going to make this building rumble.
Hopefully, you'll recognize this one. I need to go up a little bit.
I'm good. No signal down. Check that production.
I heard her. Oh, I just gave it away.
Mothra.
Yeah. Mosura.
Yeah, the only real her.
Yeah.
Oh, there's her flying.
Unless you dispute Godzilla's gender.
I love that flying sound.
Which some people have.
I know. All right. So, Josh...
He wants to talk about Godzilla's gender. You're chomping at the bit.
No, I'm good.
Well, Josh is part of the Legal Geeks, and at WonderCon, you helped present, and I can't remember if it was a hearing or a trial.
So we did a panel on lawyers versus kaiju.
Okay, that was it.
And, you know, who would win? One shall stand, one shall fall. And the issue is, like, who pays for monster attacks? So these are some of the slides from WonderCon, and so it's best of. So the first issue that we identified is it's the 85th anniversary of King Kong. And I say he's the first kaiju, Others say he's kaiju adjacent because he's part of the inspiration for what would, you know, for Godzilla and what would happen later. But there are issues with what's Carl Denham's liability for bringing Kong to Broadway and having him get out. Well, so you break it down. Well, wild animals are you have strict liability for them. So if you have a gorilla and it gets out, you are strictly liable for all that damage. So he goes to Broadway, and there's a caveat that if you have basically a license from the legislature, so either the city of New York or the New York State for having a zoo for educational and entertainment purposes, you're not strictly liable if there's, say, a bear attack. It'd be an issue of negligence. So, like, somebody climbs into the bear encounter, that's on them. It's not on you. So the issue then is, was it foreseeable that the chrome chains would break because Kong became excited and enraged with the flash photography and seeing Andero? So that would change it into a question of negligence if that happened. Since Carl doesn't seem to be the type of guy to do paperwork, and since Son of Kong begins with him being sued 11 times and grand jury indictments coming down, so he escapes the United States by going to sea on the venture again, with it's brilliant. Now, one of the people who presented with us is Monty Cooper. He's an attorney, IP law. He's the grandnephew of Marion Cooper, who created Kong. So Monty was able to add some tidbits, like the big one being the plane that kills Kong is flown by Marion Cooper. He was an Air Force pilot, and so he killed his own creation. So we recorded that, and I'm going to do a podcast with Monty this week on the anniversary because he has lots of little tidbits. The other big fun issue is, who pays for acts of Godzilla? So, like, do you deal with insurance? Because whether it's one of the U.S. movies, like in 2014, he stomps through San Francisco, Vegas gets crunched by the Muto, there's a nuclear bomb that goes off. Like, who's going to pay for all that? Well, a funny thing. Local governments can't sue, saying, like, hey, your toxic waste created that monster, therefore we want to go after you for the ambulances, the emergency services, the fact that some people are going to have to get out chainsaws to cut up corpses. Like, how do you deal with that? And the answer is, you don't. There's a lot of... That's the cost of doing business for local governments. And there are cases where airplanes crash into neighborhoods, and local governments have tried suing the airline, saying, like, hey, pay for all of our cleanup costs for your airplane that crashed into this neighborhood. And the answer is no. No liability. What about that nuclear bomb going off that should have destroyed San Francisco? But let's not talk about bad writing. Yeah, that nuclear tsunami that would make the Bay Area really cheap to live in for a short time. No liability for nuclear weapons. So we have actual case law where nuclear weapons have been tested in Nevada and people's houses have cracked and windows need to be replaced. Can't sue the United States government for nuclear weapons usage. So they would be out of luck there.
But I have to ask a question.
Yeah?
So you've talked about local governments and the same government. In the case of Godzilla, you've got a monster that was arguably created by the tests of another government, but with the added complication that your country is currently under the occupation of that government.
So a lot to unpack there. We actually we actually got into this at WonderCon with some of the toxic liability laws. And there is executive orders in place on paying for, say, toxic waste spillage on military bases. There can be some liability for the United States because it's a good neighbor thing.
Japan, we call it a version of gomenasai payment.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, here's some money.
Yeah. Oops. The Korean film, The Host, you know, got into that as well because of the formaldehyde that's dumped into one of the rivers, and They use Agent Yellow to kill the beast. Some interesting issues there. But my favorite kaiju is Gamera.
That's always what makes it fun, that it's hooked up to the sound system.
Exactly.
That was, believe it or not, that was my mom.
Momzilla.
Momzilla.
It's okay.
The that.
I'm a Gamera fan, especially the Hezai Gamera, which is, I think, hands down the best kaiju trilogy to date.
And it is a masterpiece.
He's the hero. You know, it's he will fight to the end, even alone, to make sure the bad guys don't win.
It's the friend to all children.
Friend to all children.
So that does that. So when you look at the Showa era, does he have a duty to rescue children? Because he keeps rescuing kids who are kidnapped by aliens multiple times. And there's some funny things there. So if two kids are kidnapped on a Boy Scout adventure by aliens, and the aliens demand surrender the planet or their children die, the answer is continuous fire. We're not getting the kids back, because you're not going to trade 7 billion people who will either be enslaved or eaten for two kids. So, sorry, you're going to die anyway. But Gamera's there, and he goes in and saves the day. So do we have an issue with Gamera having a duty to go out and save kids? Well, there's no duty to rescue under common law. So you can have a duty to rescue because there's a law in place, like parents have to take care of their kids. There can be a contractual relationship. You know, perhaps it's in your scope of employment. Like, firemen aren't supposed to go like, whoa, fire's bad. I'm not going in there. No, like, police don't say, I'm out. They go in. Well, you can have an implied duty based upon conduct, kind of an implied contract. Well, based upon conduct of Gamera saving children who get kidnapped by aliens and go to a planet on the other side of the sun, and he knows how to arc weld a UFO back together, there's good issues there that there could be an implied duty.
Does that make Gamera essentially like Superman?
He's the guardian of the universe.
Yes.
The absolute guardian of the universe.
You know, Superman does not have, there is not a legal or deputized duty to do what he does, but he does it because it's the right thing to do.
Which then puts you into Good Samaritan laws.
Okay.
In order to go out and do those good deeds.
The Kaiju Boy Scout.
Exactly.
Kaiju Boy Scout.
It's why I like him.
He got his badge a long time ago.
So there is an interesting difference here between the Showa Gamera, which is what you've been talking about, but you started off by expounding your joys for the Heisei Gamera, who is actually quite different. Because the Showa Gamera, friend to children, is not the Gamera we see in the 90s, who they make explicitly known in the second film, Attack of Legion, that he's really the guardian of the trees and the rocks and the mountains and the rivers. And we are just in the way. And then that becomes the main theme of the third film.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating, actually, change.
When you're willing
Gamera.
When you're willing to take out a building to take out a villain, it's like, ouch.
Shusuke Kaneko is the director of that trilogy, and he does a really brilliant way right at the beginning of part three, because at the end of part two, one of the characters turns to the other and says, well, what if we start polluting too much, or something like that? And then the beginning of the next one, it's this really operatic scene of Gamera chasing a stray gauss, and the collateral damage is immense. But very explicitly, there's, you know, a building will blow up and you see hundreds of people going up in the flames, and it's Gamera who set that off. Yeah. So it's like very, very different friend to children.
Yeah. They were just adults.
Yeah, 20,000 dead in that open scene. So it sets a tone. But the end, the flame punch.
Oh, yeah.
So we're speaking about Gamera, guys. Let me just say one thing real quickly. A lot of people have asked us. I put a magazine together called Monster Attacks, and I've interviewed all these directors and met with those people. So since I had the opportunity to meet with the director of Shin Godzilla, and he worked on the special effects of Gamera trilogy, Shinji Higuchi, a friend of mine, I asked them for you guys and for everybody else. So, everybody always wants to know, when or will there ever be a Godzilla versus Gamera? His response was, quote, "Well, sometimes dreams are better left to be just dreams." And speaking legally, that's one of the issues of Gamera and Godzilla never having.
That's why Ash will never fight Jason and Freddy.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Kong versus Godzilla. It's happening. Will happen again.
Well, one thing I get everyone to address, because one thing for me that defines kaiju, which is why I would consider King Kong not quite in the canon, is it's men in suits. And there's a particular skill and charm and quality to the films because you have men in suits. And that's why we have on these cookies, you have Haru Nakajima, who was the first Godzilla, who also... wasn't he a pilot?
He went to pilot training academy in Japan, and he didn't complete, but he was there during the war. And I mean, when I have time, I would like to write a book of my times and experiences with Mr. Nakajima, because he was an amazing man and did it so humbly. But the connections between what you guys talked about in the war and all that, it continues throughout the thread of the entire genre.
I mean, we haven't discussed Tsuburaya yet.
Let's address the men in suits. Let's talk a little bit about what goes into this and why it gives these films a unique quality.
Well, Tsuburaya is actually a good person to talk about there, because he's the special effects master behind the technique that they used to pull this off.
The father of Tokusatsu,
who ended up leaving Toho eventually and starting his own Tsuburaya Productions, and gave us many, many, many wonderful creatures and characters. But he started off in the war as a propaganda artist, doing war in the Pacific type videos and films, some of which using miniatures that would he would use these skills in these later giant monster movies. But, you know, the legend goes that some of them were mistaken for real footage by that. I'm not sure how much truth there is to that legend, but Tsuburaya sure would tell everybody that. He was given the task to create a giant monster destroying Tokyo. And having to do it, the entire production was, 6 months or something?
They stuck with that schedule for quite a while.
it's an absurd task, to be honest. And one of the real inspirations for the actual monster is Tomoyuki Tanaka had seen the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, who had the creature effects done by Ray Harryhausen. But of course, Ray Harryhausen had taken 2.5 years to give us the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. So as much as Tanaka would have loved to have seen something like that for Gojira, but it was an impossibility. So they did decide to go with a man in a suit. They found Nakajima. He had been in... It was an Eagle Over the Pacific?
Correct.
Yeah, he was in Eagle Over the Pacific, and he was a stuntman, and he allowed himself to be lit on fire for an extended period of time.
Oh, wow.
So when they were trying to find the person who would be Gojira, which is not, you know, sometimes as a kid, I was like, oh, I would have loved to do that.
Yeah.
It's not a nice and happy thing to do. It's quite strenuous. And so they're like, well, you know, there's that guy we lit on fire. And so Nakajima, and there were actually two stunt guys who played Gojira in the first film.
And one guy couldn't handle it.
He couldn't. He almost drowned.
Yeah,
he almost drowned. So Nakajima not only finished the first film, but played, I think, something like 22 more monsters in various other films, including...
Lots of background roles, too, that you probably don't recognize them unless you're really looking closely.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. And if you've ever had the pleasure, meeting him, it's amazing. But
he's like an imp.
Well, you know, when you hear
a powerful
him, with a huge, powerful smile.
Yes.
But when you hear him talk about what, you know, he really thought about why people loved Godzilla, mm-hmm. and why it was not just a another monster film. This is someone. This is arguably the biggest star. He's Japan's Elvis. He's arguably Japan's biggest star. Has been around for 60 plus years now in 30 films, and he says it's because he was in the suit. Like, you can see his humanity coming out through the performance of Gojira. And he would use lots of dance techniques, like no theater, where every movement that he made had a meaning. And he would do this in a suit that weighed 220 pounds, made out of melted tire rubber in that first year, and where, you know, a bucket of sweat had to be poured out of it every time he made a change. It's incredible how much life he couldn't move. If you remember in the first one of my favorite scenes is they brilliantly shot this great scene where Godzilla is stomping through and it's over a bridge, and it's a composite shot, so they time the foreground, which is the arches of the bridge, with Godzilla's feet coming down and all this water rushes out of the arches. You know, it's really innovative stuff and really convincing and beautiful, but the feet are so slowly dragging across because he couldn't move, but it gives this sense of like size and grandeur that it just worked. And that's
it was heavy to lift those feet.
He was a larger-than-life person until the very end. I mean, you know, just before he died 2 years ago, he was still, like, talking privately, mm-hmm. you know, and about his acting.
There's a great...
how he loved it.
There's a great book by McFarlane Press on the kaiju genre that breaks down the different Japanese storytelling styles, mm-hmm. and how... the kaiju films and Godzilla specifically invoke like three different storytelling styles in the films. And it's fascinating because it's something that's extremely traditional and modern and sci-fi all at the same time.
All right, why don't we do another little...
Oh.
Let's do another...
Let me turn the sound back on in case mom calls again.
Momzilla. Is there a sound for Momzilla?
No, okay. No sound for Momzilla. I could call her and then we'll all hear it. But
yeah, love you too.
This one's one of my favorites in terms of this sound. So again, raise your hand. That was fast. That's Ghidra, King of Ghidorah.
I love that sound.
Yeah. I believe those were organ keys.
Yes. Affected.
But effective. And then, of course, the sound of the flying, too. It's hard to hear. But that's not quite right.
Is that from Monster Zero?
This is from Monster Zero, yeah. Actually, no, I lied. This is from Ghidra, Three-Headed Monster.
Okay. All
right, one more?
One more.
Ah! Raise your hand.
Wait for it.
Wait for it.
Steady.
Use the force.
Stay
on target. That might be hard. Ooh. One of my favorites. Let's see. That's not quite right.
That's kind of hard.
Let's take this. Yeah, that. If you got that, you deserve like all the cookies. Say it again. Nope, that's not right. Let's go back. Would you get that one? Yeah. I'll give you a hint. This one's a little harder, but I'll give you a hint. This is one of the few of Ishiro Honda's giant monsters that explicitly on screen ate people.
Yeah,
yeah.
And also one of Nakajima's favorites,
Varan.
That's a great guess. Not Varan the. No.
Rodan.
Not Rodan.
But did eat people.
Rodan did eat people. Yeah. But did you really see it?
You really see it in this film.
Yeah.
Some television versions were edited.
That's true.
Wait. That's the Green Gargantua.
Yes, Skyra, the Green Gargantua.
The words get stuck in your throat.
Cause the words get stuck in my throat.
And the dress gets spit on the floor.
She survived.
And later the band Devo covered.
She was the producer's girlfriend, right? Yeah, at the time.
She had a weekly gig.
If you haven't seen War of the Gargantuas, it's amazing. This is how amazing it is. Like 4 or 5 years ago on the Oscars, they did a segment where they asked a bunch of celebrities to talk about the film that they remember as kids, and everybody came up with, you know, Hitchcock and all these others. Brad Pitt talked about War of the Gargantuas.
So that's the film that made him get into acting.
That's the yes.
My feelings about him just changed.
I know, doesn't it?
Like, for the better. It's like, huh.
If you somewhere on the internet, I did a fake podcast where I tracked the influence of War of the Gargantuas in Brad Pitt's entire filmography. That was fun.
All right. Did anybody else want to add something about suit acting or about how it impacted kind of the way you appreciated these films?
Gosh, Nakajima-san was considered the god of suits and the guy that made it all happen. You guys talked about Kamen Rider earlier, so a new genre started then in 71, the golden age of tokusatsu. But when Nakajima started doing that back in 54, it hadn't been done. And we talked about the scope of how hard it was. He had to literally pull a costume around with a car battery inside of it, you know. And the materials weren't readily available in Japan at the time, so they didn't get the best, you know, prosthetics or whatever they had. They were really bad, really caustic, they burned. Nakajima almost died 2-3 times in his career doing those heroes and monsters.
What was the car battery for? I've never heard
of it. For the lights and for some of the powers, for the eyes and stuff like that. And they had different versions of it, but like he could barely move sometimes. And sometimes he passed out in the suit, like, you know, passed out, knocked out, turning blue. You know, when he played in Rodan, costume hit the water and he was drowning. They don't call cut. They didn't call cut back then. They don't call cut now. So he just kept on fighting. Anybody seen Ultraman with Jidas? Ultraman fighting Jidas? Okay, so Nakajima taught Furuya-san, Ben Furuya, how to play a monster. He was more of a model and an actor, and he got behind the suit. So they always gave Nakajima the interesting roles, and he played Jidas with a clamshell on his head. So since he taught Furuya how to do acting, when he came to that episode, he literally hit Furuya hard in that wetsuit. So afterwards, Furuya was bruised and beaten. And so he loves that episode, but he hates it. So there's a weird dichotomy, and there's a really strange sense of working back then. It doesn't exist now. And no matter what movie you see today, they all tip their hat to Nakajima forever and ever.
I should mention, too, that we were very lucky to see a Men in Suits panel at Monsterpalooza. This was a few years back, but Nakajima was on the panel with, you know, Tom Woodruff and Doug Jones and all this. And, of course, like, everybody knows Doug Jones. He's a genius. We love him dearly. And one thing made me love him even more is it got time for Nakajima to talk, and they mentioned how heavy the suit was. And Doug Jones stood up and made everyone give him a standing ovation. And it was beautiful. And it was a packed auditorium. It was the best experience of my life.
Well,
just seeing that happen.
I thought you were going to mention the Monsterpalooza panel where there were the two suit actors.
Oh, yes.
So there was Monsterpalooza's had some great panels, but there was one where there was somebody translating for them, and finally they just were like, and they
Kiriyama and Satsuma,
and they reenacted. Was it Destroyer?
It was Destroyer. Yeah.
So they reenacted it on stage, like what it took them in terms of the movements they were doing.
Wow!
And it was amazing.
We got it on video. Beth put it on YouTube.
It's on YouTube somewhere. Yeah. I can't remember where, but yeah, it was great because they were basically just showing you what they were doing without the suits on, so you could see, and they were describing along the way how, you know, what their thought process was.
And it was great because Kiriyama actually wasn't in that film. He played Godzilla in the Millennium series, so he
but
had
he took
to
on
fake
the role.
Playing yeah. Destroya. So he started like doing these wing movements. Oh, it's so good.
Wow.
And here's the beauty of all this. People like you guys in the audience that love these films, Nakajima-san, Kitagawa-san, Satsuma, all these gentlemen who played the monsters, they weren't that popular in Japan. These conventions started in 96 in Chicago, which brought them here originally, kind of expanded.
G-Fan?
G-Con, but G-Con G-Fest, expanded their popularity to the point where they became more popular again in Japan because of their notoriety here in America. So they have something, you know, very magical, but you guys and your friends and fans of Godzilla helped to create it here in America to export it back to Japan, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing. I remember Takarada, Akira. He actually, his first G-Fest, he actually shed a tear because he had no, I mean, he had a room full of Americans giving him a standing ovation as he walked in. He had no idea anyone knew who he was. And you know, this was back, you know, one of his first appearances. And that's the, that's a magical moment.
And now he's the navigator of Godzilla culture.
Yes.
Officially.
Do we want to take any questions? Is there anybody have a question before we...
Or a question for Roshi or...
As you can see, he's
almost done.
Oh, beautiful. Look at this.
That's just
beautiful.
A masterpiece right there. Inspiring envy in all of us.
He does it by hand. He doesn't work in the digital realm. So if you see his comic book and you come down and check out his artwork, it's all by hand. So some people come by the table and said, I drove from LA to meet him. I drove from here to meet him. And he's the dying breed. But he's just, you know, breaking out now. He's got a comic book coming out in the future with Akira Takarada in it.
Oh.
So I want to ask you guys a question, because if you go online right now and were to Google kaiju, sadly what comes up are Pacific Rim monsters or a few other things. But so for you, what defines, what really defines something as being kaiju? What elements or what things do you really need to have something that you feel is accurately described as kaiju?
Well, it has to be a strange beast. And it has to be big.
Daikaiju.
Yeah, we're not going to have the pint size strange beast. It's got to be big. It's doesn't this, in my book, it doesn't have to be destructive. For some people, they want that. Maybe I'm more on the optimistic side of things. Because even though Godzilla might have been born from, you know, PTSD from World War II, we're friends now. And like, if a giant monster stomped through Japan, we would be there fast. Like, we would not leave them alone. And it's, I don't remember which Japanese leader said this, but it's best to leave World War II in the past and look towards the future. So I feel strongly on that. But a strange beast, big, powerful.
For me, what really defines them, I always go back to Ishiro Honda, because he had the most relevant for me approach to them. They're slightly tragic. They don't fit with us, so their destruction is not done with malicious intent per se. It's got an air of tragedy to it, and really they're not. Godzilla is not a big lizard. He's not a big iguana, right? It's a force of nature. So this is something that goes a little beyond the realm of human comprehension or understanding. He's not an animal. He's more like a tsunami or a typhoon or a mushroom cloud. So the sense, you can't just shoot him with missiles. You know, this is something that comes and leaves occasionally smoking rubble in his path. In the earlier series, either in a way that's not so nice, or either in a way that is saving us all from someone like Ghidorah. But
hey,
yeah.
Well, that is one of Godzilla's most heroic depictions.
I know. I just like Smog Monster.
Yes, it is Earth Day.
It is Earth Day. Celebrate.
Save the Earth. So that's me.
I always wondered about this question, so I never had this question posed in a panel. But I asked this question to Koichi Kawakita. Do you know Koichi Kawakita?
No.
So he's a special effects designer who learned from Eiji Tsuburaya. In his very office, he used to have a film camera, a 16mm film camera that was used on the first series of Ultraman. So that was his reminder.
Wow.
Next to his desk, he had an oxygen destroyer next to his phone. So his phone's here, oxygen destroyer's here. He lived and breathed Godzilla culture, so he was the former navigator of Godzilla culture. His last project was the Godzilla Hotel. Anybody seen
that? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So he's the one that made that happen. He's the one that made all the Godzilla Fests happen for many, many years. So we had an interview in 2014, just before he died, for Famous Monsters that I wrote. And I asked him that very question, because I always wanted to hear what they had to say. And he simply said, in America and other countries, they make monster and creature films. Japan is the only country that can make kaiju films.
Mm.
And that's kind of the way I feel.
Yeah, I feel that too.
Everything else that I've seen in America, they're great movies here. 2014 was fun. Nakajima enjoyed it. But it's not a kaiju film in the eyes of the people who work on it.
You know, that's on that note, I think one thing that you can really, if you wanted to see that in action, if you see the end of most or all, really, American giant monster movies and the monster is fallen at the end, it's a triumphant scene with blasts of brass and people going, yay! At the end of Gojira, and a lot of these, it's not. It's much more somber, it's much more tragic, and it's there is no joy that comes with that.
Well, it's like the end of Shin Godzilla. Godzilla is basically frozen and they have to live with it, which is like living with nuclear waste, living with something, you know, extremely dangerous that can come back and crush you. So I'm like, that ends shot so well directed and framed with Godzilla in the distance and the hero politician right there. It's like, that's cool. But at least that's forward-looking, because it's the United States is there with them. We're not imposing anything on them. Granted, their view of U.S. politics is weird, but they're...
It used to be Axis, right?
Yeah. it's weird, but what they did, it shows how the country comes together when threatened. That's a common theme in all kaiju movies, whether it's, we're going to make a blood-spinning rooftop on a hotel to get Rodan, or develop mazers to take out the gargantuas. Like, the country works together and they solve the problem. And like, that's one of the positive aspects of this, is the problem can be solved.
And that's Japanese culture in general.
Yeah.
So there's a disaster, FEMA comes in, we complain, we cry. Not everywhere, some places. Japan, you see the 85-year-old person walking out there sweeping, you know, the police aren't coming, the neighborhood's taking care of things. That's their culture for hundreds of years.
It's inspiring.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. Question?
Yeah. What would you guys say for each panelist is your absolute favorite kaiju film? What's the one that does it for you more than anything?
So hard.
Oh, God.
Go ahead. You got it?
I'll go with Gamera, Advent of Legion.
I'm just going to not say Gojira because that's too obvious, but I've always been partial to the Godzilla versus Mothra, or Godzilla versus the Thing is how I first saw it, but I just love that film. I just love it.
I have no explanation for this, but it's Hedera. It's the Godzilla versus Hedera. I don't know why I've collected all these Hedera figures. It's just, I think I also admire that the poor guy in that suit was suffering, and it's the only one where Godzilla flies.
And you see Satsuma versus
Nakajima. It's just
Nakajima.
Crazy. It's like on an acid trip.
Yes.
It is.
That's a close second for me, since I saw it in the theater as a second grader with my entire second grade class.
Awesome.
But the first one's War of the Gargantuas, because it came on television every summer where I was at. And the emotion in Nakajima is amazing. Mm-hmm. And having, you know, worked with him and helped him. And just, if you watch it again, watch the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They opened up the creature for him. So he always considered himself an actor. He considers everybody else suit actors.
Compare his...
He always considered himself an actor. And if you watch that movie, you can see he's really acting.
Compare his performance to Russ Tamblyn's in that film. Yeah, you'll see.
All right. Let's give a big round of applause for the gorgeous...
Yoshi will be down at the table in the Eaton Room, and if you guys are interested in buying this one piece that he has, it's available down there. It's one of a kind, created just for San Diego Comic Fest. I've got a few prizes here. I don't know who's the oldest in the audience. The oldest person.
Oh, wow.
Who's over 60?
This is a
concert shirt from a band that does special effects. They actually do music, and they do actual Godzilla songs. Wow. Who's the youngest of the audience?
Sam!
You know what? This is a t-shirt from Osaka. It's Frankenstein Conquers the World of Baragon.
Woo! And Sam will appreciate it.
Awesome. Baragon is my wife's favorite kaiju.
Yes. So come down to the booth as well, if you would. There's a few things down there that you will not see anywhere else. And just give us a shout. Come by and talk about kaiju and whatever else you want to talk about. Thank you.
Let's thank all our panelists here. Josh, Miguel, and thank you all for coming.